Welcome to the Monsters and Myths Show, where we shine a light on those innovation inhibitors and obstacles you're likely to encounter on your innovation journey. Now, before I go on, I have to say this is being recorded on Friday, the 13th of November, 2020. Friday the 13th are bad enough anyway, but a Friday the 13th on 2020, I think we were tempting fate. And this was at the insistence of today's guest, seeing that Friday the 13th sort of lined up with our monsters and myths. So if anything goes wrong in the show and we have an appearance of a monster or two in the form of a technical glitch, you probably know why, because this is going to be recorded, edited, produced, and published all today on Friday the 13th, just because that's why we set this as the date. So my guest today is Katarina Dow. She is the CEO and founder of MicoMe, which is a platform that enables people and organizations to create, access, and share data with explicit consent. Katarina is a huge advocate of the ethical use of personal data, specifically with consent, with parameters around it. So we share a very strong bond over that because she is a very strong privacy advocate. I've known Katarina for about 5-6 years now, and I've been very much looking forward to this. If any of you have ever seen Katarina on stage, you'll know that she's a fireball. Our conversations always go in weird and wonderful directions and delve down rabbit holes. So without any further ado, Katarina, would you like to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your journey so far, and how come you've seen so many monsters and myths to date?
Hi, Andrew, and hello, everyone, and thank you for having me. And thanks for agreeing to Friday the 13th. I thought in 2020, we might as well tempt fate as far as we can go. So let's see what happens, and maybe we'll bust the myth that of Friday the 13th. So that's great. So a little bit about me, because I think it would be fun just to dive into the conversation and see where it goes. As Andrew said, I founded the company Mico back in 2012, very quickly. A massive sci-fi fan, always had a really active imagination. I saw the film Minority Report around 2002, which sort of painted this both super exciting and dystopian view of the future, where we were living in a fully digitally immersed world. And one of the things that really struck me when I first saw that film was that if we didn't have a sense of digital agency, if we were moving to a world where everything was tracked and traced, and we kind of had this exoskeleton of data, and there was our digital self, that as a society, we would probably need to make that evolution from the physical world to the physical digital world by starting to think about how we operate as part of that. And that's a whole show in itself, kind of the background story, but that led to what we now call the API of Me, which is simply the ability for you and I, in the various roles we have in life, citizen, customer, patient, student, employee, to have access to bring our data together with data from a service provider and create mutual value. And as Andrew said, we always look at that through the lens of collaboration, of consent and permission, but with the focus of creating a better outcome. So how does one and one make, you know, more than two or three? And if we think of ourselves working and living and participating in a digital society, then what will come as a result of that is increased rights. And so from a privacy point of view, it's trying to work out how do we retranslate many of the privacy technologies that we have in the physical world, windows, doors, clothing, you know, the ability in the physical world to say, I'm comfortable with you seeing this or not. How do we now retranslate those physical norms into the digital world so that we don't have our digital windows open all the time?
So. And it may seem that right now that's extremely topical. Have you seen The Social Dilemma on Netflix? People get sick of me talking about it because I keep on bringing it up, but it's raised the need for people to be more aware of how their data is used. But you were perhaps at the time an idea before its time. And I can remember that when I first discovered you guys, it was because I was scanning the horizon for what was coming next. And I know all the marketeers were all, you know, doing somersaults over the Minority Report, thinking that Hollywood is real. And so they all wanted it today, yesterday, you know, they wanted it immediately. And with you establishing MECO when you did, I expect that you must have met with a huge amount of resistance and many monsters, because you were thinking way ahead of where the industry was at the time. Your thoughts around privacy and data use and all that was really, nowadays people go, oh yeah, that makes sense. But back then it was like, huh?
So I think that's a really great lead-in, first of all, maybe to share with listeners and people watching our discussion, how we met and how that connects, I think, into the monsters and myths I'd love for us to riff about. So in the monsters, it's this idea of mindset. So I'd love for us to go down that rabbit hole together. And then the other thing is misconceptions. But I also want to talk about signposts, because if we think about mindsets and the ability for all of us to imagine, and look, the bottom line is when I started the company or when I came up with the idea for MECO, it was way too early. Everyone said to me, you're crazy, you're mad, no one cares about personal data. Like, why are you doing this? I had family members begging me, you know, I started the company. And funded it out of salary for a couple of years before I raised money. And you know, I had people saying to me, you know, no one cares about this thing that you're working on. And when the company was formed, the idea, 2011, 2012, early 2012, I wrote a manifesto, which still guides us every day. You find it on our website. And, you know, it started with the question, this big question of, up until now, you know, organizations and government has sort of had this power through data access to, you know, basically make better decisions or create value. What if you and I had that value? And just after writing the manifesto, there were a couple of signposts. And this leads into you, Andrew, being one of those really important signposts. So two signposts that came very quickly for me, they were signposts for me, and my mindset was reading the Facebook IPO documents, which were published, don't quote me, but I think around May 2012, something like that. And what I was looking, after writing the manifesto and having this idea that each of us could basically have our own API and we could plug that into the organizations we trust, or in a peer-to-peer way, we could connect and exchange data in a way that created great outcomes. I read the Facebook IPO documents, and what was really obvious to me in reading the risks were that there were four things that were going to be obvious at some point in the future. And again, to me, because when I talked to others about this, they just said, you're crazy, I don't see it. But the four things that jumped out were that people may become aware of the value of their data, like that at some time in the future, that actually is something that is more universally accepted. But there may be issues around privacy, and that as the business model that was detailed inside the IPO, as that unraveled, whether or not that would create issues from a privacy point of view, which meant that may be something that could be subject to regulation. So does that mean that we would have regulation in market? And then last but not least, at that time, Facebook was moving from desktop to mobile, and so a lot of their business model was becoming opaque and under the surface. So for me, that for me was this huge signpost that said, okay, if you want to create something that if you think those things that might happen, then why not create a privacy by design platform with full transparency that could make a regulator happy, that could make a citizen happy, that could make an ethical enterprise using that information happy, and why not design it mobile first? So that was a really good signpost for me. And then not long after that, I think I discovered that Kuppinger Kohl, the German analyst firm, had written a really interesting, I would call it white paper, but maybe it was more a positioning paper on life management platforms, which was this idea from the perspective of privacy and control. If we had access to our data, how could we improve sort of our decision making, access to services? You know, I would highly recommend the paper. I think the paper was very prescient, and it's as true today as it was, I think, 2012 when it was published. So let's fast forward a couple of years. Everyone said, you're crazy. Okay, fine. Went off and started the company. Then we raised some money, and then we built the first version of the platform. And, you know, there were all sorts of monsters, myths and risks and like so many things along on the way just to get to that point sort of 2 years later. But then I was in London, I guess. It wasn't a long time after we had launched, and I ended up in a Chinese restaurant with a bunch of people. I think Andrew was still with Visa Labs at the time. We got seated next to each other, and you started talking. I think you'd been at maybe Money 2020, or you'd been at somewhere in the US where you'd given a presentation, and you were talking about this startup that was working in the personal data space, and you're talking about it, and I'm sitting there, and I can feel this knife in my heart thinking, oh my God, there's a company out there doing exactly what we want to do, and you're getting all animated and excited, and I can feel my heart breaking, and I'm thinking, oh, we've worked so hard, and this company, whoever they are, you know, they're obviously people are finding out about them, and then you reach into your bag and you pull out an iPad, and then you show me Miko, and you say, have you heard of this company? And it's like, yeah. So for me, you know, in the scale of monsters and myths, for anyone that's listening, where you have an idea that you feel you cannot not follow, one of the big monsters is everyone telling you can't do something, you're crazy. And maybe you are, maybe you'll fail, you know, maybe I'll fail tomorrow, maybe I'll fail in 5 minutes, you know, maybe I'll fail in 100 years. That possibility is always there. But if you stay true to that mindset of doing something you really believe in, then make sure you keep your eyes open for the signposts. Because Andrew, for me, was one of those important moments that you never forget, you know, sitting next to a stranger. I think there were 10, 12 of us at this table. We were randomly seated next to each other. And you pull out of your bag and you show me the thing that we have built with all of the, you know, love and attention and frustration. And you think, okay, maybe I'm not so crazy. And so I think one of the biggest monsters that we struggle with in not just in technology, you know, in the advancement of our society is that we get stuck into a mindset of how things are or should be. And that can make it really hard for anyone that wants to walk the path less traveled. And I think for me, the magic of us meeting, Andrew, was that it was like meeting tribe, you know. Instead of you saying, oh, you're crazy, it was like, oh, wow, fantastic. And then, you know, that's the beginning of this wonderful connection that has just blossomed over the years. I feel very grateful about.
I was number one. I was glad that you didn't get angry that I had taken screenshots off your website and just used them in a massive keynote that I had done, because I can remember that on my iPad, I had about five screenshots. I was so taken with what you were doing, and I was speaking at a conference all about the potential value in data if it's used correctly. And when I'd come across Miko and you had these great graphics that explained exactly, you know, about how you can get mutual value, both for the customer and for the company. It doesn't have to all be one-sided. And we were thinking at the time, and I was still working at Visa, and we were going, what comes next after the cost of after the amount of money we can make off a transaction drops to such a low degree, where next are we going to get revenue from? And the most obvious thing was data. But it was, how do we make money from data in a way that doesn't compromise the trust relationship that we have with our clients? Yeah. And to me, that's what Miko had epitomized, actually, was the whole thing was built around mutual trust and trust that was earned, you know, through mainly explicit consent. Number one, I was happy that you weren't cross with me for raiding your website for the screenshots. But number two, I couldn't believe it was total serendipity that I got sat next to the CEO and founder of this damn company that I was so excited about, that I'd only discovered in my horizon scanning activities at the time. So that was, it's actually one of the things that I miss the most about our current lack of physical events, because that opportunity for serendipity just doesn't happen. It's never happened since then, and that was about six years ago. It was back in about 2014, 2013 even. It must have been 2013, because
I think it was, we launched July, August in London, 2014, yeah. And I think it may have been during that trip, which means, like, you know, there's no way I could have been cross, because it's more that moment of, wow, like, we've just put this creation out into the universe, out into the world, and does anyone even notice?
And you were from the opposite end of the blooming world as well. I mean, you had launched, created this in Australia, and who the hell in London cares about Australian startups? No disrespect to anybody in there, but that was the typical thing. Was, you know, it can't be important if it doesn't come out of America or Europe. And I had just, you know, shown and opened a whole lot of people's eyes, a couple of thousand people at the conference that I had just done, to this. And I went, you got to go and have a look at this. This is the way that we need to be moving. So being very excited. But I also recognized immediately the barriers that you must have been facing, because I built up a reputation for being a professional shit stirrer anyway. And I was used to, South African thick skin. I'm used to people going, you're bonkers, you're off your head. And I have to go at it a number of times before I get them to see it. And I tell lots of stories. I mean, you know, that I tell lots of stories and anecdotes to illustrate points so that people can see things from another perspective. But that's my day job. That's what I do. But I recognize that for a startup like yourself, that you must have been in such a difficult position, because you were banging on doors and getting them slammed in your face the whole time because nobody could see it. So your whole concept around mindset, it's the mindset of the innovator, that you need to believe in yourself. And if you believe in yourself, that will shine through. But it's difficult. How do you cope? How do you get that self-belief in order just to carry on going? Because it's a thankless job in the early years of a startup. I mean, people might look at you now and go, oh, you know, look at Miko. They've done this and they've just launched that and all this. But they forget that the first, you know, 5-6 years was total grind, where you carrying on going, and you've got to have a really strong mindset to keep going and not just give up. How do you How do you keep it? How do you kill that monster? How have you managed to stay so cheery all the time?
One, I really love. I love what I'm doing. I love what we are doing as a team. I'm fortunate to be alive right now in this crazy period of history. It's fascinating and interesting. I have, I'm sure, I shouldn't say all founders, but I think it's not unusual for founders to have, you know, dark nights of the soul. I can't remember whether it was I don't want to misquote, but I think it's one of the famous Sand Hill Road VCs that said, you know, being a founder is, you know, like being a baby, sort of waking up in the middle of the night and crying. So I wouldn't paint the journey as, you know, beer and Skittles, because it hasn't been that. I think to mindset, it's my temperament. It's my wiring. And I think it's positive, and it's also really negative, both sides. So if I see something and it seems tangible to me, despite what anyone says, you know, it's kind of like my North Star. And so I think that mindset of something seeming so obvious was really kind of what pushed me forward, or continues to sort of say, okay, this, I can see this, it makes sense. So I think maybe that's the positive side of it. I think the negative side of it is that it can make that journey incredibly isolating and lonely at times, which is why meeting people like yourself or getting that feedback or finding some of these signposts, whether or not it's somebody's white paper or a presentation or somebody sending you a kind note, you know, those things I think help support that mindset. But I also think it's a particular kind of temperament, because by the time I had decided this was something I wanted to do something about, once the genie was out of the bottle, I couldn't not do it. And in the early days, I used to say to the team, look, we are going to be the most fantastic failure or brilliant success. And those are the two options. So if we fail, you know, the last screenshot should be beautiful. The way we communicate should be as clear as possible. The last keynote, the last conversation with a potential partner, the last engineer that joins the team, all of those things should be on the basis of this paradox of possibility. This is going to just fail or it's not. And so I think part of that mindset is finding your own way to walk between those two things. And, you know, the terror that I still, you know, our team during COVID, our team has grown by 8-9 people, and most of those people we've only met digitally. It's a really weird thing. And so the company has almost doubled in size over this last sort of 9 months, and that's terrifying. It's exciting, it's wonderful, but it's also really scary, because all of a sudden, you know, I feel this increased responsibility to more people, their families, their kids, you know, our partners, our customers, our shareholders. So I think the scary part, at least for me, has never gone away. But the mindset of, do I believe in this, and are we putting everything into this, and are we giving this our best shot, I think is part of what maybe helps balance that out. But at least for me, and it may be different for others, the idea that potential between the possibility of everything going well and everything not is true in every moment. And I think before we got started, Andrew, I mentioned to you that one of the things I wanted to talk about was my favorite one of my favorite quotes around the responsibility of anything you create. And it comes from a French tech philosopher, Paul Virilio. I probably haven't pronounced that correctly. But he says, when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. When you invent the plane, you also invent the plane crash. Every technology carries its own negativity, which is invented at the same time as technical progress. And so I think to the issue of mindset, it's recognizing that everything we do has this possibility to be both wonderful and destructive. And part of it is how you walk that fine line between those two things all the time, every moment of the day. Yeah, I don't think that ever goes away.
I think that quote of yours, I've never heard it before. That's just given me a whole pause for thought, because it does very much touch on, and I'm glad it comes from a philosopher, because philosophy is lacking in the world of technology. We rush too quickly to do things, and we do things because we can a lot of the time. And I think that right now there's a big focus on ethics, and we know that in Edelman Trust Barometer, ethics is one of the most important things that can move a company's trust score. And I think that whole concept of, I love that, when you invent the plane, you invent the plane crash. When you invent the ship, you invent the shipwreck. That's not something that we think about enough. There's a big monster in there somewhere. It's either a monster or a myth. I haven't decided which, but how do we, because this is a monster, or it's a misconception, it's something that has to be addressed from the outset, because a lot of organizations will rush into doing something because they can, or doing something because their motivation for innovation or transformation is revenue-based, and they'll latch on to the first thing that we can do this because it's going to make us more money. Okay, I'm sure that right in the early days when Facebook started, I don't believe that the original people that were sitting there doing some cool stuff had thought it would turn into the absolute monster that it is today. Yeah. And it is a monster. It is a complete monster, and it's a money-making monster. And I think that the things that it's done, it's done more and more and more of, because it's focused on revenue. And there's a lack of ethics and philosophy around a lot of the stuff that has been done in the past. I can't comment about whether or not anything that they've done recently will change that. But how do we address this? How do we approach this? What do you encourage people to do? You know, is it as simple as taking time for some introspection or reflection? Is that going to impact the pace? Can you imagine in an agile sprint, you say, no, we've got to put some time there for us to sit and think about it. Then they'll go, well, what's the point of us doing agile? No, we've got to do. How do we tackle this monster? Because that's a monster I wasn't expecting to be raised there, but it's such a great quote that.
I think there are a couple of things. If I'm really specific about the emerging space that we're working in, and when I say emerging is that we're, you know, we still are living quite a physical existence alongside the digital, but I think we're fast moving to a place where those two things are just going to be so merged. It's going to be very, and particularly because of what's happened as a result of COVID and the fact that the way we connect has become much more digital. So first of all, I would say there are some things that really worry me if we don't take pause. And then the other, I would say I would draw some inspiration from history. So the things that worry me is that the Facebook model kind of said, okay, you can make massive amounts of money from data. And I see there's a lot of innovation going on around the data space, particularly the personal data space, that says, okay, well, if I could just get that data myself, you know, whoever I am, you know, whether that's me as an individual or me as a community, and I could control that, then I could monetize it, really simple. So, you know, Facebook bad, they should stop doing it. Me, I'll do it. So I personally have concerns around this race to the bottom of saying, okay, well, now if I can just have that data and sell it, then I stop someone else from making money and I'll make the money. And I think what worries me in that is that we've missed this massive opportunity in a transformational way from into a digital society. And this is something, Andrew, you and I have spoken about over the years, and that is, you know, if I sell a parcel of data for $5, £5, €5, and in that parcel of data is the ability for me to have made a better health decision, education decision, mortgage decision, career decision, then it's incalculable the value between those two aspects. And our philosophy, I use that word because the company was started really asking this question. The power of what could happen as data has existed in organizations, governments, social platforms, because they have that compute power. What if you and I had that? And so part of the reason to take pause is, if we fast forward, maybe not 10 years, maybe not 20, but if we think 50 years into the future and everything is connected, if we've not thought about what digital agency means as humans, and we haven't kind of worked through that, then it's just scary. And it's to your point, you know, just because we can doesn't mean we should. So like it or not, we are the generation. This is the moment where we are wrestling with these things. Conversely, history tells me that this is not a new set of challenges. We have wrestled with these same things 100 years ago, around the same time as the same pandemic. You know, if we said now, you know, take your five-year-old child and put them down a coal mine and have them work, you know, take in the city of London all of your household waste and dump it into the Thames every single day. If we said, you know, you can only vote if you are at a certain standing in society. So if we think of the new norms that formed when we moved from an agrarian culture to an industrial culture and the Industrial Revolution, and we started to look at things like air quality and the right to vote and working hours and worker safety and whether it was right to have children working and the Declaration of Human Rights. When we think of all of those things that actually came out of us moving from one way of operating as a society to another, we're just really lucky that we right now are living in that same crossover period. And I don't know whether that takes a decade or two decades or however long that takes, but we right now are living in this period where the industrial world has become incredibly sophisticated. We've moved into the beginning of the digital era, and we can't function in this new digital era in exactly the way that we did in the industrial, in the same way that we couldn't in an agrarian. So we need new norms. And the good news is previous generations worked through those things. So I'm optimistic, but there will be some plane crashes through this process. Absolutely. Because it's a process of elimination. And back to this idea of mindset, there may be people in society that can see those plane crashes hurtling towards us. But one of the big problems with mindset is if you don't have buy-in and it's not tangible and people can't see it as a ever-present threat, then the idea that I will delay doing anything about that until it affects me, my family, my household, my country, my democracy, we leave things sometimes too long before we take that action.
that actually that aligns with something that Leda Glyptis had said a couple of episodes ago, where she spoke about the myth of we have time. And she had raised it in a different concept, but it's the same myth. And one of the things that I love about doing these shows is reinforcing the existence of a myth through multiple different anecdotes. And she had said exactly the same thing, is that we constantly propagate this myth of we have time to do X, we have time to sort it out, we'll get round to that. And as you say, the era that we're going through now, and it will be marked down in history as an era. It'll almost be like looking at the rings in a tree kind of a thing. You'll be able to see something big happened here, and that's going to be 2020. You know, the world changed in a step way. And hopefully what we create as the new normal will be better than the one that came before. It's not guaranteed that it will be. Hopefully we've got enough history to be able to prevent us from doing the wrong thing over and over and over again, the definition of stupidity. But to your signpost bit, it's we need to be aware, we need to be looking for the signposts. I think that the problem is a lot of the companies, a lot of the organizations, they're not looking for the signposts, and therefore they don't notice them. So they work under the, you know, they have to get stuff done right now because they've got a fire to put out in their own organization. They have their own problems and they have their own things. And I would caution people not to do too much navel gazing and keep within their own echo chamber. And I would encourage them to look for the signposts around them, and particularly to think before they do at the moment. We've hit 34 minutes, which is we've already gone over what I
3 minutes.
What I try and keep these sessions to. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Is there, unless there was any other burning topic that you had wanted to bring up? I mean, I'm sure we could carry on for ages.
Of course, we could talk for hours. So just a huge thank you. It looks like we have, well, you haven't edited and shipped this yet, so I shouldn't jinx it. But so far for Friday the 13th, it seems to have worked. And just a huge thank you to you, Andrew, as the embodiment of a signpost. And I guess my parting thought was, if you really believe in something, if something inside you is propelling you along, and you feel at times like, you know, no one understands what you're trying to do, or you haven't been able to communicate that, keep your eyes peeled for the signposts, because those signposts are people, their chance encounters, their little tiny snippets of feedback that help you adjust. I wouldn't say our journey has been this straight line. It's been adjustment after adjustment after adjustment. And some of those adjustments come as a result of those signposts. But there are, if you are keeping your eyes open, those signposts are out there, and if you're lucky, they will be embodied by somebody that you can enjoy a fantastic conversation, glass of red wine, and a halfway decent Chinese meal.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Katrina. I'll put all your social links in the show notes that people can figure out how to get hold of you if they want to follow you and find out more about the Miko journey. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you. Bye.